It's time to begin. If you would, take your Bibles and turn to 2 Samuel 14. 2 Samuel chapter 14. We're going to start there in verse 25 in a moment. Brent had the first class this past Lord's Day, and I've got just a few questions as we go through. And if you want to answer, raise your hand. If you take more than like 5 seconds, I'm just going to answer. So don't be shy. My name's David, for those of you that don't know me. And if I don't know you by face, I don't see real well right this time of night because of the lights in the OR during the day. Just make my eyes tired. All right. First question. This kind of starts in chapter 13. Who was David's oldest son? Absalom. Oh, those aren't coming up one at a time, are they? There we go. Amnon is his oldest son. For bonus points, which we're not really giving bonus points, who's his second son? What's that? Second son. Absalom's number 3. It lists them in, I think, chapter 3 of 2 Samuel. If y'all want to turn there, we can look at that real quick. Chapter 3 and verse 2. Sons were born to David in Hebron. His firstborn was Amnon by Ahinoam, the Jezreelitess. His second, Chileab, by Abigail, the widow of Nabal, the Carmelite. And third, Absalom, the son of Maacah, the daughter of Talmai, king of Geshur. Now, where is that going to come back into play at? Probably already experienced it in the class last Sunday. Anybody? Speak loud, huh? Yeah, why would he escape to Geshur? So where his grandfather is, right? So absolutely. Shame on me, I didn't turn my phone off, you guys, and I'm getting all kind of calls from Tennessee for some reason, but I don't know why. All right, who was Amnon? That's the first son. He was in distress over somebody. Who was it? Tamar. Yeah, that was. Whose sister was she? We've got all kind of different sons of all kind of different wives. And how are they all related? Just briefly. Absalom's full sister, so it's Amnon's half-sister by David, different mothers. Absolutely. All right, so he was in distress over her. Who instructed Amnon in how to get Tamar alone? Jonadab. Jonadab was his name, but yes, David's nephew. Kind of... questionable character. He's just a bad guy, isn't he? As is Amnon. So, moving on, next question. After Amnon violated Tamar, how did he feel about her after that? Yeah, he hated her. I mean, the language before that was kind of weird, right? He made himself sick over her. It's like he always thought and thought and thought, what can I do? What can I do? How can I get her alone? Jonadab told him how to do that, and once he does that, he acts all kind of foolishness towards her, and then he hates her for it. So what happened to Tamar after this? What happens to her? She basically spends the rest of her days in Absalom's house. There's no talk of her becoming married or anything like that. She just remains single in his house is the way it sounds like. How did David react towards Amnon? How did David react towards Amnon? Yeah, no action is talked about there. Just David was very angry. Now, he had a responsibility there, but maybe he was thinking along the lines of, who am I to come down on anyone for some sin like this after what I've been guilty of? We can't get inside his mind besides to say he was angry. Next question, how long after this did Absalom take action?
2 years.
2 years. Two years afterwards. So it's a pretty long time. He's just kind of waiting, biding his time, and his anger is growing the whole time, it would seem like. What did Absalom do to Amnon? What's that? Yeah, he said, I want to go off. I'm going to have a sheep shearing, which is kind of like a big party, a festival type thing that he's going to throw. Make a lot of money there and all that kind of stuff. Let Amnon come down. I don't think it's a good idea. And he kept pressing him, and David finally let him come down. And It's a big plan. Hey, my servants, you guys kill Amnon as soon as I give you the go-ahead with that. It's a sinister ordeal. So he had his servants kill him. And where did Absalom flee? We've already talked about that, right? Where did he go? Geshur, to the realm of his mother and grandfather, and he stays there for quite a long time. You get the idea. He's quite comfortable there when he's talking later to Joab about coming before King David. He's back in Jerusalem for a couple years, and David won't see him the whole time. It's been better for me to stay in Geshur. Why'd you bring me back here? Just a few more questions. Who did Joab hire to go before David? Anybody remember? She don't have a name, right? It was a woman. Woman of Tekoa. Yeah, a woman of Tekoa. Who else was from Tekoa? Just a bonus question about the scriptures. It's a prophet. I think it's Amos. Somebody double check me on that. But I'm pretty sure it's Amos, the sheep breeder from Tekoa. Kind of a rough, that's a rough business to be a part of. But he was a sheep breeder from Tekoa, which is kind of south of Jerusalem. What was the story of the woman from Tekoa? What was her story? Go ahead. Right. It's kind of a ruse. I mean, it's absolutely a ruse. Hey, Joab tells her, go before King David with this story. And what's his plan in doing that? Bring Absalom back home from Geshur back to Jerusalem, to that area. And so she has this story, like Brent was saying, my two sons, one of them rose up and killed the other one. Now they're wanting to kill the son that killed the other one. That's going to extinguish my line, and that's just not going to be good for me. We won't have an ember left, basically, in Israel. And then she turns around and says, may I speak with the king? Why have you not brought back your son, is the idea there. And David automatically knew. Did Joab put you up to this? And the obvious answer is yes. So what did David do as a result of Joab's efforts there? Right. I think I'm doing something weird on this clicker. There we go. Yes, he brought Absalom back from Geshur. So, you can. Yeah, it is. I'm not sure. I kind of wondered that myself, but I couldn't come up with a good reason. But there's some things behind the scenes that we're not told everything between them over the years. They've known each other for a long time, and maybe it just kind of must have had the hand of Joab all over it from different things in the past, and this one just happens to be recorded for us. Anybody have an idea about that answer to that question? Why would David see Joab immediately in this ruse? Great question. I'm just not sure the answer to it. All right, so let's move on. That gets us kind of caught up. Just like to do a little bit of a backpedaling a little bit to remind us what's happened up to this point, so we'll try to do that every time. We're going to start in chapter 14 and verse 25. Chapter 14, verse 25. Verse 24 said, and the king said, let him return to his own house, but do not let him see my face. So Absalom returned to his own house, but did not see the king's face. You know, it's strange, the treatment here of Absalom. Absalom has murdered someone, but it's totally different than the treatment of Amnon. He's being much harsher, although still not doing what he's supposed to do as the king. It's just kind of bizarre for David to be doing these things. We're told some strange things about Absalom to get started. Verse 25, now in all Israel, there was no one who was praised as much as Absalom for his good looks. No one praised as much for his good looks. I'm going to figure this out, y'all. There, no one's praised as much for his good looks as Absalom was. From the sole of his foot to the crown of his head, there was no blemish in him. And when he cut the hair of his head at the end of every year, he cut it because it was heavy on him. When he cut it, he weighed the hair of his head at 200 shekels, according to the king's standard. Now to Absalom were born 3 sons and 1 daughter, whose name was Tamar. She was a woman of beautiful appearance. What do y'all make of this description of Absalom? Praised for his good looks, we're told. He was without blemish and had impressive hair, right? The hair thing is just kind of strange. There's kind of echoes here of characters from the Old Testament and different things from the Old Testament, right? Praised for his good looks, you think of Saul. It says there's no one better looking in Israel than Saul was during his days. So you automatically think, well, this is not going to be good. Remember when David was being anointed as the next king of Israel, what did God say to Samuel? Don't look upon what? It says, don't look on his appearance. Basically, God's saying, I judge the heart, not the appearance. And that's just how I deal with things. He was without blemish. What else do you know of that's without blemish? That particular type of language. What does it make you think of? It makes you think of Christ. It makes you think of the Old Testament sacrifices that they were supposed to have, were supposed to be without blemish, that kind of thing. Certain times, certain priests that were supposed to serve before the altar were also supposed to be without blemish as well. Just kind of an odd thing to put out for him. And then what about his hair? Does that remind you of anything? It does remind you of Samson. And he has these foolish characteristics too, and the hot-headedness and all of that, kind of like Samson. I don't know if we're supposed to think of these people, but I did when I was reading through it. So anyway, anybody else have anything to add to this portion of what we're talking about here with Samson and it describing his attractiveness? All right. We'll move forward then. So it also talks about him having, chapter 14 and verse 27, 3 sons and a daughter whose name was Tamar. She was a woman of beautiful appearance. What about the 3 sons? I don't know if y'all have skipped ahead a little bit. I know you've skipped ahead in the past. If you remember when Absalom dies, it says that he had built a memorial for himself in the king's valley. You remember this? Because he didn't have any sons. Well, here he had some sons. But what must have happened? Must have died when they were young. Not an uncommon thing in that day and time. You know, back even 100 years ago, if you didn't have a child or two that had passed away at a young age, that would be remarkable. Today we don't deal with that near as much, and that's a good thing, obviously. So his attractiveness. Now he names his daughter Tamar. Why do you think he did that? That's a gimme. Yeah, keep her the memory of her sister alive. And how many Tamars do we know in the scriptures? Yes, I heard 3. Over here, I heard something from back there. We couldn't make it out. Probably 3. We've got Tamar in Genesis 38, which is the daughter-in-law of Judah. And now we got Tamar, David's daughter, which is Absalom's full sister. Now we got Absalom's daughter, also named Tamar. All right, so now we've got Absalom coming up, and he's been in exile for a while, and David brings him back to Jerusalem. But what's the catch of him coming back? What can he not see? Face. Can't see David's face. He can't come before David's presence. It's kind of a half-hearted way of reconciling between the two of them. How long did he go before he was able to see him again? Yes, it's 2 full years. It's quite a long time. For him to be back and basically just in his own house, which would have been probably outside of the city walls of Jerusalem. Why would we think that it would be outside the city walls? Well, my field is next to Joab's field, and go burn his field, right? You don't have fields inside of Jerusalem. It wasn't a really big city for people to have fields there. So it must have been a little bit outside the walls anyway. So moving on, verse 28, Absalom dwelt 2 full years in Jerusalem, but did not see the king's face. Therefore Absalom sent for Joab to send him to the king, but he would not come to him. And when he sent again the second time, he would not come. So he said to his servant, "See, Joab's field is near mine, and he has barley there. Go and set it on fire." And Absalom's servants set the field on fire. Then Joab arose and came to Absalom's house and said to him, "Why have your servants set my field on fire?" And Absalom answered Joab, "Look, I sent to you, saying, 'Come here, so that I may send you to the king to say, why have I come from Geshur? It would be better for me to be there still. Now, therefore, let me see the king's face. But if there is iniquity in me, let him execute me.'" So Joab went to the king and told him. And when he had called for Absalom, he came to the king and bowed himself on his face to the ground before the king. Then the king kissed Absalom. So we now have a full makeup between David and Absalom in what we're supposed to have happened there. Actually, it's been 2 years in the making, or maybe even longer when you consider how long he was gone. So he didn't see him for 2 full years. Set Joab's field on fire to get an audience with David, and Absalom and David appear to have this reconciliation there. There's a lot of sermons online talking about burning the barley field. I just wanted to bring this up. If you kind of look up Absalom burning Joab's barley field, it's going to talk about this idea. A lot of sermons, even amongst people in the church, that talk about, and they're not bad, but basically the idea of God gets your attention by setting your barley field on fire, making things go wrong in your life to get your attention to start doing right. And, one way or another of looking at that, but those are certainly out there for people to read and look at. Now, what happens next after they reconcile? You would think, well, they're going to fully make up, but we have a problem, don't we? What's going on with Absalom? Yeah, Absalom is not he's not a fool. He acts foolishly sometimes, a lot of times actually. But he knows how to get what he wants. It seems like he waited a long time to get Amnon and to kill him, and now he's 2 full years. He's not happy while he's gone to Geshur. He's not happy the 2 years he's back. Finally gets an audience with David, and David accepts him back. But now he is going to put into play some plans that he seems to have been cooking up for a while. So as Tony said, he starts his plan up here. Let's read a few verses in chapter 15 and verse 1. After this, it happened that Absalom provided himself with chariots and horses and 50 men to run before him. What does that sound like he's doing there? He is the king's son. Where else do we see this idea of getting horses or donkeys or something like that and men to run before you? Yeah, you do see it in the Judges, don't you? Can't remember their names. Ibzan, Elon, Abdon. There might be one more that does the same thing. You read them. Oh, he got 30 donkeys and men to run before him, 70 donkeys and men to run before him, something along those lines. The idea of making yourself look very important. He doesn't have a lot of other things to do, does he? So he's came up with this plan. And he puts forth an image that he wants to portray to the people. So, next thing he does, verse 2. Now Absalom would rise early. Think about some of the things it says here, just kind of more, a little more in depth. Look at some of the words. He gets up early. And he goes and he stands beside the way to the gate. He's not even in the gate. It's early. He's on the road some distance away from the gate, and he's waiting for people to come up, right? So it was whenever anyone who had a lawsuit came to the king for a decision, that Absalom would call to him and say, "What city are you from?" And he would say, "Your servant is from such and such, a tribe in Israel." Then Absalom would say to him, "Look, your case is good and right, but there's no deputy of the king to hear you." Moreover, Absalom would say, "Oh, that I were made judge in the land, and everyone who has any suit or cause would come to me. Then I would give him justice." Well, what's he doing here? He's seeking to be known as some sort of a solution that the people need, right? Maybe he's painting a picture. Things are not good. You can go before the king. Your case is not going to be heard. You're just going to be left out of the mix here. And if I was king, it wouldn't be that way. I would do things differently, and you would get justice. This guy's a great politician. He's a really good politician. It's just what they do now, right? Only if I was in charge, things would be different. And there's a lesson there for us, man. You know, we need to learn. If we were in charge, maybe things wouldn't be different. Maybe they'd be different. Maybe they'd be worse, right? Keep ourselves in our place. He capitalizes on his plans. How long does it take for him to capitalize on his plans? That's kind of a trick question. We look here at chapter 15 and verse 5. So it reads on, "So it was, whenever anyone came near to bow down to him, that he would put out his hand and take him and kiss him. In this manner Absalom acted toward all Israel who came to the king for judgment. So Absalom stole the hearts of the men of Israel." So he's getting a following, isn't he? And he's doing this day after day. How long does he do it for? How many? It's kind of a tricky question there. Some of the versions say 40 years. Some versions say 4 years. The oldest manuscripts that we have say 4, which makes more sense. How long did David reign? He reigned 40 years. So if Absalom is waiting after Absalom's born, if he's waiting 40 years to do all this, and David's going to be dead and gone. So 4 makes more sense. The Septuagint dates, the copies we have date to around 300 AD. They say 4. Syriac version, which dates to around 200 AD, has 4. And the Dead Sea Scrolls, which dates to about 200 BC, also has 4. So some of the Masoretic texts, which the earliest ones we have date to around 800 AD, have 40 and a few have 4. So you can make your own mind up for that. Just want to put those out there. All right. So he capitalizes on his plans. Takes him 4 years to do it, which is quite a long time of seeing people on the way to the gate early in the morning and all day long into the city and tell them, "You're going to be disappointed in what's about to happen to you. You're trying to get judgment. You're not going to get it. But, if only I were in charge, things would be so much better. And everything would be great for you. But lo, I'm not." But he is getting a following, isn't he? He is getting a following. It would. Meet that one person, you influence them, and then may go back to their home place and talk him up a little bit. Boy, the king's son, but he sure is a good one. Forget about the fact that he murdered his brother, right? He was right to do that. You can almost hear it being talked about. So Absalom has a lot of scheming that he's been doing. He looked important. He seemed to have the people's best interest in mind with what he wanted to do. He went to Hebron then, didn't he? And let's read a few more verses here. "Now it came to pass after 4 years that Absalom said to the king, 'Please let me go to Hebron and pay the vow which I made to the Lord. For your servant took a vow while I dwelt in Geshur in Syria, saying, if the Lord indeed brings me back to Jerusalem, then I will serve the Lord.' And the king said to him, 'Go in peace.' So he arose and went to Hebron." What's he about to do in Hebron? Anybody? He's about to say, hey, Absalom is king in Hebron. Why Hebron? Why would he do it there? Is there something special about it?
David's king there for 7 years.
There you go. That's where David's kingship started, isn't it? David started in Hebron. This kind of gets you to thinking back. He's going to be a David-like person in his mind, it seems like. And so he goes there. And verse 10. And Absalom sent spies throughout all the tribes of Israel, saying, as soon as you hear the sound of the trumpet, then you shall say, Absalom reigns in Hebron. So all these different cities, he sent people there. We're going to send you runners. You all hear about it. Proclaim that everywhere. Everywhere that you get the news, have people say, Absalom is the king in Hebron now, not David in Jerusalem. He's not going to stay in Hebron, though. We know that. Verse 11 says, and with Absalom went 200 men invited from Jerusalem, and they went along innocently and did not know anything. I think that's a kind of a interesting statement to make about the 200 there. I don't know what to make of it. If you got something about that, I'd be interested in hearing it. But it's just kind of strange that amongst these people that are scheming together, there's 200 that slide in. They don't know what's going on. And they're just kind of in the mix. All right, so verse 12, then Absalom sent for Ahithophel, the Gilonite, David's counselor, from his city, from Gilo, while he offered sacrifices. And the conspiracy grew strong, for the people with Absalom continually increased in number. He's got a lot going on here, doesn't he? He went to Hebron, proclaimed himself king, then he recruited David's best counselor. What is said about Ahithophel later, about his counsel? Just so we know what kind of guy this is. What's that?
Doesn't say much for loyalty.
No, it doesn't say much for that. What does the scripture later say about Ahithophel's ability to counsel the king? The word from Ahithophel was like instructions from God, something to that effect. It's a little bit later, maybe in the next chapter or two, when Ahithophel starts giving his counsel. The best counselor that could be at the time. And so Absalom's got him as well. Things are not looking good for David. His conspiracy even continues to grow, it tells us. David sent for Ahithophel the Gilonite, David's counselor from his city from Gilo. We read that. Verse 13, now a messenger came to David, saying, the hearts of the men of Israel are with Absalom. Yeah, he's got people everywhere. He's got at least people in every city. Now, let's think for a minute. Think about David. What does David do with this information? Hearts of the people with David. It seems like he gives up right away, doesn't it? Well, we got to get going then. It says in verse 14, so David said to all his servants who were with him at Jerusalem, arise and let us flee, for we shall not escape from Absalom. Make haste to depart, lest he overtake us suddenly and bring disaster upon us and strike the city with the edge of the sword. That's pretty bleak, isn't it? What are some things? Let's think about who David is at the time. How old is David at this time, probably? Anybody? He's probably around 60, somewhere there, maybe past 60 years old. Now, he's going up against his son, who's got a lot of people with him, and David may be thinking, there's no way I can lead people into war again and win against this guy. Kind of shows a lack of faith, doesn't it? It is. Yeah. Yeah, he kind of doesn't do that till he's across the Kidron and maybe up on the Mount of Olives, and he writes Psalm 3, which we'll read in a minute.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of little things going on there. So David may have also thought, this is part of my punishment, right? He's been told some stuff that's going to happen, right? We have the whole thing that happens with Bathsheba. He sees a Bathsheba, takes her, lays with her. She gets pregnant. He ends up killing her husband. And then Nathan goes and tells him, well, you're the man. You're the man that stole the ewe lamb and killed it and served it to your guest, right? And what all is going to happen? Remember, there's four things that's going to happen to David according to the mouth of Nathan from God. Got that already, don't we? Yeah, and this is kind of part of that. The sword will rise against you also, and doesn't it also say from your own house? Not just the sword won't depart from your house, it's going to rise against you from your own house. The child will die. I'm forgetting the fourth one. We got the important ones, though. Your wives, there we go. That's coming up, isn't it? Your wives will be lain with in the sight of all Israel in the open sun. So that happens next chapter, that when Brent's going to talk about that in chapter 16. Yes?
We'll see later how David felt about Absalom when Absalom dies. Maybe he just has no heart to fight.
Yeah, that's kind of a third option as well, isn't it? I don't have the heart to kill him. I mean, even when it comes down to full-blown war with him, what's his instructions? Oh, deal kindly with the young man Absalom for my sake. This is war. That's not a way for success. At least Joab realized that. And Joab's got some big problems as a character, character issues, but he knows how to get things done, and he knows that's never going to work. So the conspiracy continued to grow. Then David does up and flee from Jerusalem. The decision to flee was his own. Everybody said, we'll go with you. We'll back you in that. And he had people come that he didn't think probably would come that did. So let's look at a few of those. He left just the 10 concubines there to keep the house. And you read that, and you think back to what Nathan said from God is going to happen, and it's like, why couldn't you see this coming? Why did you leave them there? But nevertheless, we don't have all the answers. His servants are willing to submit to his decision to up and leave Jerusalem and go out into the wilderness to flee. Chapter 15 and verse 15. King's servant said to the king, we are your servants, ready to do whatever my lord the king commands. Then the king went out with all his household after him, but the king left 10 women, concubines, to keep the house. And the king went out with all the people after him and stopped at the outskirts. So they're leaving Jerusalem. I'll have a map of Jerusalem here in a minute. Couldn't find a great one, but they didn't go very far, because once you leave, I think the map I have has the temple area in it. There was no temple yet, right? David wants to do that later, but it's just the city of David, which is the southern part. And you don't go very far. You can actually see it easily from the wall of Jerusalem. You can see the Kidron Brook going through the valley there. So they're not very far, because that's where he stops and they all cross over and he watches people cross over, that kind of thing. So let's look at that for a second. We'll try to get through with all of this. Then all his servants, verse 18 says, all his servants passed before him, and all the Kerethites, all the Pelethites, and all the Gittites, 600 men who had followed him from Gath, passed before the king. Now, who are these folks? Where are they from? It's like Kereth, Peleth, and Gitt. No, these are Philistines that have gone away from Philistia, and we're going to see with Ittai, which he talks to, which is a Gittite. He's been exiled from his own country and came to Jerusalem. They're kind of David's royal guard, and they're executioners as well when he needs them, apparently. So that's who these folks were. Verse 19 talks about Ittai, the Gittite. It says, why are you also going with us? Return and remain with the king. Who's the king he's talking about? He's talking about Absalom. Go return and remain with the king. For you are a foreigner and also an exile from your own place. In fact, you came only yesterday. Should I make you wander up and down with us today, since I go I know not where? Return and take your brethren back. Mercy and truth be with you. But Ittai answered the king and said, as the Lord lives, and as my lord the king lives, surely in whatever place my lord the king shall be, whether in death or life, even there also will your servant be. So he's going to come as well. Now we have others that are coming. Verse 23, all the country wept with a loud voice, and all the people crossed over. The king himself also crossed over the brook Kidron, and all the people crossed over toward the way of the wilderness. Now, I think it's talked about them already passing over the brook and going up Mount of Olives. I think now in this next verse, it kind of drops back a little bit and adds something that happened during the crossing over the brook, which is saying this. Verse 24, there was Zadok also, and all the Levites with him, bearing the Ark of the Covenant of God, and they set down the Ark of God, and Abiathar went up until all the people had finished crossing over from the city. So we've got two priests, some Levites, the Ark of the Covenant at the brook Kidron, and the people crossing over. You think we're supposed to see something from the history of Israel in that? Well, when they crossed the Jordan, it was kind of the same thing, wasn't it? This is not near as miraculous. I'm not saying they split the water and walked over on dry ground. It was just a shallow brook. But nevertheless, that's kind of the imagery that we're looking at here. All right. Let's see if we can get through with this in about 5 minutes or so. So, got 3 minutes. Sorry. David flees Jerusalem. He sets up a spy network. As we already talked about, Absalom's got Ahithophel, the Gilonite, David's best counselor. So, Zadok and Abiathar, he tells him, they're wanting to go with him. He says, no, you take the ark back to Jerusalem, and you go back to Jerusalem as well. And use your sons as runners to run me information from there. Then he gets another visit. Chapter 15 and verse 27. The king also said to Zadok the priest, are you not a seer? Return to the city in peace, and you and your sons with you, Ahimeaz your son, and Jonathan the son of Abiathar. See, I will wait in the plains of the wilderness until word comes from you to inform me. Therefore, Zadok and Abiathar carried the ark of God back to Jerusalem, and they remained there. So David went up by the ascent of the Mount of Olives and wept as he went up, and he had his head covered and went barefoot, and all the people who were with him covered their heads and went up weeping as they went up. Then someone told David, saying, Ahithophel is among the conspirators with Absalom. And David said, O Lord, pray, turn the counsel of Ahithophel into foolishness. And it happened when David had come to the top of the mountain that he worshipped God, there was Hushai the Archite coming to meet him with his robe torn and dust on his head. And David said to him, if you go on with me, then you will become a burden to me. If you return to the city and say to Absalom, I will be your servant, O king, as I was with your father's servant previously, so I will now be your servant. Then you may defeat the counsel of Ahithophel for me. And do you not have Zadok and Abiathar the priests with you? He says, I've got a network set up for you to try to frustrate Ahithophel, try to put forth some stuff that's going to counteract his advice, which is probably going to be good, and get Absalom to listen to you. So verse 36, indeed, they have there with them their two sons, Ahimeaz, Zadok's son, and Jonathan, Abiathar's son. And by them you shall send me everything you hear. So Hushai, David's friend, went into the city, and Absalom came into Jerusalem. So they've made it out of the city, made it over the Mount of Olives, and here coming in a short time later from Hebron is Absalom. How far away is Hebron from Jerusalem, by the way? I may have a map. You can't really tell from the map. It's about 18 miles. That is way too small for anybody to see. Sorry about that. If you're looking at that, this might be bright enough. Hebron is right here. Jerusalem's up there. It's about 18 miles. And David is heading off to the east, down towards the what is called the wilderness of Judah here. So anyway, and you can see on the right side, here's the Kidron Valley, the brook Kidron running through it. And this is, if you're standing in the city of David and looking off to the east, this would be the city wall that someone has taken a picture from. And you can see the Kidron Valley with a wet weather stream, the Kidron Brook today, running through here and off this way. So anyway, any questions before we end? All right. Thank you very much for your attention. And Brent will have the next.